You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagechefpodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's bastienhughes.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes. The first five people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to bastienhughes.com, because many, many times we get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we've created, and then just think, well, what's next, what now? Well, bastienhughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
I found myself on the stage with one of the guys from the Tommy play and a few other musicians, and we were playing Sympathy for the Devil. And when everything kicked in, there was this gring sound to my left, and I looked over, and there he was playing the guitar. He was in that kind of military stance where he's holding the guitar like a gun, and, you know, he's just sort of pounding it, you know, strumming it really hard and pounding. And so I'm playing Sympathy for the Devil with Pete Townsend.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestagelefpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Madness, Oasis, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis Presley and David Bowie. Today we are joined by renowned music journalist SiriusXM DJ and songwriter Jeff Slate, who will be sharing his thoughts on the music industry from both sides of the fence, having interviewed members of the Beatles no less, to performing Bowie songs alongside Bowie's legendary guitarist Earl Slick and performing with Guns N' Roses' Duff McKagan. Jeff was tasked with writing liner notes for the 50th anniversary reissue of Sgt. Pepper's and has interviewed most living legends in the music industry and has a distinct solo career to boot. What more could someone want from their CV? So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Jeff Slate. Thanks for joining us today, Jeff. How's it going?
Thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it. It's always fun to listen to the introductions.
It's like a nice little reflective piece. It's, I remember I did that.
Wow. That guy must be cool. Wait a minute, it's me. That's terrible. No, anyway.
Well, we are going to delve into some of that stuff in a little while. The first thing, I've just finished recently watching Get Back, and obviously the Beatles are a band that are very close to your heart in many, many ways. I presume you've seen it, and if so, what surprised you most watching Get Back?
How long it was?
No, it was long.
I think it's interesting. You know, we think of the Beatles as, especially now that John Lennon's been gone for so long, we think of the Beatles as very democratic and very, you know, I know there was a line of thinking for a long time, certainly when I was a kid, that it was John and Paul and George and Ringo were sort of, you know, background players, which obviously was never the case, and we know better now. But it was interesting to me to see how George and Paul and Ringo were very much peers. But when John walked into the room, all eyes were on John Lennon. You know, that even when he was, you know, drugged out most of the first episode, or, you know, just not that engaged in parts of the second episode, it was fascinating to see that when he perked up, or when he came in the room, or when he started to play something, or even just talk about relatively benign stuff, not even important stuff, everybody sat up and kind of paid attention. Like, he was John Lennon even to them, which you know, I think we forget how sort of dynamic and charismatic he was in real life, even in a group of people who, you know, George Martin had known him a long time at that point. The Beatles had been the Beatles for, you know, 10 years, you know, Paul and George had known him for a very long time at that point. But he was still, he was still John Lennon. It was interesting to me, you know, Paul McCartney, who's sort of never trying to impress anyone, was, you know, sort of trying to impress John Lennon. Oh, I've got this new song, or hey, how about this? Or, you know, it was very interesting to watch that dynamic very much in real time. So that was the, you know, that was sort of the fan takeaway. The other thing was it was really, really long. You know, I'm sort of waiting for the unauthorized fan edit of like 2 or 3 hours so I can just pop it on and watch it. But look, I think at the end of the day, I had to see it a little early to write the piece that I did for Inside Hook about it. And that was fortunate, but I was in a crunch, so I had to watch it all in one day. And I don't recommend that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. I don't recommend that to anyone because it's first of all, it's hard to take in all that information in one day. But secondly, when you watch it in that context, all you get is context. You don't really get the nuances. And the nuances are what makes Get Back special. When you have that much time with people that we've never seen working in that way, certainly not the four of them together. We've gotten documentaries of each of them individually, but not the four of them in that intimate way. You get a whole new perspective on how they collaborate and work together. And I think, you know, it's the little things. It's like John and Paul singing Don't Let Me Down. And, you know, John singing the line one way and Paul singing the line the other way. And John goes, oh, wait, what are you doing? And Paul says, and he goes, oh, well, I'm doing this. And then, you know, just a couple of minutes later, John has, you know, sort of taken the best of what Paul was doing and the best of what he was doing and made the line that we know, you know, as the line in the song. And it just happened in a split second. And for me to see that little piece of the collaboration, the way it was just sort of so fluid and so perfect, that was the coolest thing to me.
Do you think in any way it redefines some of the story of the Beatles in the, you know, I assumed I would see a lot more tension between John and Paul at that stage in their career, but actually they were very playful and they got on great. And actually a lot of the tension was between George, wasn't it, and the other members of the band. And there's obviously a point where he walks out. Do you think that it undoes a lot of biographies or a lot of kind of narratives around the Beatles by producing this? And was there anything in there that you think, yeah, just redefines the story of the Beatles in any way? Or was it pretty much what you thought you'd expect?
Well, it wasn't what I expected because I didn't know what to expect. I mean, we'd had this story about the Get Back, Let It Be sessions for so long that had been sort of not just assumed by the armchair scholars and the people who've studied them, but even the Beatles themselves. You know, George certainly was the primary person who talked about it as being miserable, but John did as well. And I think, you know, part of that had to do with the headspace they were all in the aftermath and being sued by Paul and coming to terms with that. And, you know, there were a lot of, you know, sort of ancillary issues that created that dynamic and that narrative. But look, I think if you watch all 8 hours, it's pretty obvious that they were near the end of the road. And I think, you know, I think Paul Weller said this in something. It's like it's great that they went out at that point, that they knew that kind of, you know, things weren't working. They were on the road to Abbey Road. They were already working on some of those songs. One big splash, and then let's just sort of see what happens. I mean, even George is talking about, well, we'll do our own things, and then when we're ready, we'll come back and do this Beatle thing. He did many interviews in around the time of the release of All Things Must Pass where he said that. And it just sort of, you know, I think then when Paul and John started sniping in the press, that was kind of it. And the legal issues really dragged on and created a chasm between them. On a personal level, that was just hard to get them all in the room at the same time, probably. But, you know, I think what they also probably realized was what more could they do, you know? I mean, Lennon said this in an interview very late in his life where he, you know, it was basically, if we came back, how could we do better than Come Together, She Loves You, Yesterday, you know, whatever, you know, the list of songs, it's like, it would just be a nostalgia act. And I think, you know, these were guys who had pushed the envelope and done something new with every single album they'd done. And not just in their own lives, but in the business itself, it had become, even already in 1980, sort of a nostalgia business. You know, they were already selling nostalgia grease and Sgt. Pepper movie and, you know, all these other crazy things. So I think, you know, what I got was these were guys who clearly loved each other. It was nice to see the dynamic in real time. George was absolutely done being a Beatle. He just was not, you know, he was happy to do the job and he put his all into it. But he was also like, you know, I'm looking at my watch for people who are listening. And, you know, Ringo, too, was his head was on The Magic Christian, which he was about to film with Peter Sellers. He was just like, you know, in the very first, he's talking about, oh, it's only going to be 2 weeks. And I think it's Dennis O'Dell is like, yeah, no, that's absolutely, it's not going to be 2 weeks. But whenever, you know, then we'll get to this next project. You know, he's already becoming a movie star and thinking about other things he can do. You know, and John had Yoko. And I don't say that with any negativity at all. I think she completed him in a way that we as outsiders can't possibly understand. The hardest thing was to watch Paul, you know, seeing his, not just his friends, but his band that clearly defined him, falling apart around him, you know? And he still had this relationship with John, with all of them, but it's clearly not working the way it had. And he says, you know, he expresses his frustration in having to be like the leader since Brian Epstein died, Mr. Epstein, as they call him, which is crazy. And it's just sort of, you know, it's this situation where all his hopes and dreams are sort of evaporating right there in front of him. And you can see it. And he's a little passive aggressive with people. And he's it's because he's Paul McCartney. I mean, you got to, you know, we're watching them. And when you watch them for 8 hours, they become, you know, sort of less than, they become almost regular people because the quality is so great and it's so intimate. And then we get to the end and they do the rooftop concert and you're like, oh shit, they're the Beatles, right? I forgot. They're this amazing group who blows everybody off the planet. So, you know, that's a long way to answer a short question, but I think those were the things I got.
Was there anything else from an emotion? Did anything kind of trigger your emotions in any way? And I'm not saying you'd be sitting there bawling your eyes out or anything like that. But, you know, for me, there was a part where McCartney says, oh, I'm just going to do some piano practice while some of the others are, well, John hasn't turned up. George hasn't turned up. Linda sat there with Yoko and Ringo is reading the paper and he goes and sits down. And he starts writing Carry That Weight. One, I think he goes into You Never Give Me Your Money. Then he also does Long and Winding Road. And it's really interesting. Mal Evans, who had met a really, really tragic end, I'm sure you know, he's actually coming up with lyrics with Paul. It's like he's kind of desperate to collaborate. Now, I don't know if Peter Jackson edited it in this way deliberately, but the cutaway shot is Ringo reading the paper. And like Mal Evans, he actually comes up with the lyrics standing, so in Long and Winding Road. And that was just kind of such a microcosm, I think, on how the Beatles were in that case, in that stage, that the Beatles really, you know, Paul wanted to collaborate, he wanted to do stuff, but they were individuals who were just kind of being shoved together in a room.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The thing I got from that particular scene, I think Mal Evans, it's well known that he was a sounding board for Paul. Not, I wouldn't think of him as a collaborator in any meaningful sense, but, you know, they, you know, when Paul went off to France and filmed the Fool on the Hill thing, it was Mal who shot the footage. And, you know, they were sort of, you know, they had this little bubble where they were safe. You know, they were safe with Mal. They were safe with Neil Aspinall and some other people, George Martin, Brian Epstein, and so forth. You know, when you get to that level of fame and when you're creating at that level too, there's nobody like, you know, Eric Clapton tells a story about when George invited him to play on my guitar. He was like, oh, I can't do that. You know, nobody felt like they could pierce that bubble. So I think the interesting thing, so I think that's, you know, it was interesting to see, like you said, happen. But I think what was interesting to me was that they keep talking about how they need more songs. And there was this sort of, you know, there was a weird dynamic and they kind of, you know, are arguing a little bit. And they take a couple of days off. And when they come back, Paul has a bunch of songs. Nobody else has any songs. You know, John has a couple of songs he'd been working on. That's pretty much what they work on the entire time. They play Don't Let Me Down umpteen times and Dig a Pony umpteen times. You know, George is clearly reluctant to share. You know, people say they rejected All Things Must Pass. I don't think George wanted them to get their hands on All Things Must Pass. They couldn't get that change in the middle eight right. And they couldn't, you know, it was so weird to watch it. Like they weren't putting, it sounded great and it would have been great if they'd focused on it, but they had this crunch. And I think there was nuance to that song that needed to happen. And he felt that. So he brings in a 12-bar blues. You know, it's like, well, we'll just do For You Blue. That'll be good enough. But what was interesting to me is, you know, Paul goes off for the weekend when they have a day off, when everybody else probably does nothing, and comes back with Long and Winding Road. It's not complete, but it's already there. I mean, the melody is there, the chord structure's there. And that's a, you know, look, it's not one of my favorite songs, but it's a monumental song. Any songwriter who just like, oh, I was just hanging around at my place on Sunday and I wrote this song. And if it was Long and Winding Road, everybody they know would be like, holy shit, how'd you do that? We just think of it as another Paul McCartney song, another Lennon and McCartney original. So that was my takeaway from that, that he was, so effervescent in his creativity. He was kind of, oh, you know, he's just like the Get Back scene where he's just sitting around strumming his bass in A and Get Back pops out. I mean, and they're, you know, George and Ringo are watching him like, this is the most normal thing in the world. And we're all watching it like, holy shit, that's Get Back happening right there. So, you know, I think what was interesting to me was to watch how Paul McCartney is just this endlessly creative guy and became the driving force in the Beatles because of the dynamic and the shift after Brian Epstein died. That, you know, George was very much the soul, very much the pragmatic guy who had, you know, who was like, whoa, 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 we can't even get, you know, we're not going to go on the QE2. We can't even get free amps from Fender, you know, that guy who you need in a band, and delivered those solos that we can all hum in our heads. But and Ringo was Ringo. I mean, you know, that you know, he completed the four legs of the table. But, you know, it was also, I got to go back to what I said at the beginning. It was really, really interesting and fun to see John Lennon alive and John Lennon being, you know, he's not aware he's John Lennon when he walks in the room, and everybody's kind of like, Glenn John's trying to impress him and George Martin wants to know what he thinks. And, you know, everybody's going, do you want a cup of tea? And, you know, meanwhile, to him, he's just John Lennon. But we see him and we see this super charismatic guy who everybody looks to as the leader, even though Paul is the titular leader at that point. So that was sort of my takeaway. Again, a long answer to a short question.
Can you talk a little bit about working with Paul, obviously on the record, and also about the tour?
Okay, well, working with Paul's always a pleasure for me. You know, I know him really well, and he's still one of the finest bass players, the most melodic bass player in the world. And he was in L.A. He was doing the Grammys, so I said, come over, I have this song. And I asked him to come and play on Peace Stream, mainly because, you know, there's a verse about John Lennon, so I thought it'd be nice if we were there. Still carrying on the peace and love.
Now, I think something a lot of people will be interested in is, in the process behind this, is you've interviewed Ringo, right? So you've interviewed a Beatle. And it's something I think about a lot, because I get asked, like, oh, who do you most like on a podcast, et cetera, et cetera. And apart from your good self, it would be, I'd love to speak to a Beatle, just because I think that I would really overthink and over-prepare for that. And I wondered if you could talk us through that process of when you interviewed him and how you kind of prepared for that. Because, you know, I've listened to, say, when Mark Maron interviewed Paul McCartney, he does this kind of whole big thing about he found out he was going to interview Paul McCartney. And it's like, where do you even begin? And it got closer and closer to the event. And he said that, actually, I wasn't as buzzed as I thought I would be because I realised I was more of a John guy. And he gets to then this whole kind of route about, actually, he didn't care about Paul so much. And then there's Adam Buxton, who you may or may know of. He had McCartney on a kind of a year or two ago. And his approach was, because everyone would have, you know, they would have been asked everything there was to be asked, he actually just asked the most mundane questions, like, what is your favourite breakfast? And, like, do you like Marmite? And stuff like that. And it's actually quite amusing. It's really insightful. So when you're interviewing Ringo, like, where do you begin and how did you go about that?
Well, so over the years, I've interviewed Ringo maybe a dozen times. And at this point, it's weird. It's kind of just another interview, although I will say a couple of years ago, before all the pandemic stuff, I was at an event with a drummer friend of mine, and Ringo knows us both, at least. He knows this drummer friend much better than me, but he knows me. And he walked out, and he was on his way to the stage, and on his way, he walked past us and went, hey, Billy, hey, Jeff. And I was like, holy sh! It occurred to me in that moment, in a room full of people watching him launch this book, oh my God, he knows my fucking name. That's insane. You know, that just blew my, I still like, you know, blows my mind. But it was a weird, the first time I interviewed him, it was obviously a sort of an out-of-body experience, but I had met him a couple of times already. So I got to interview him or meet him the first time because I'd done some work with Pete Townsend. I got to know Zach Starkey, and I wanted to see the All-Star Band, and he put me in touch with the office, and they, you know, gave me sort of passes, and, you know, that was great. And I took my son to an event, and, you know, he got to meet him that time. And then a couple of years later, I took both my kids, my daughter, it was her fourth birthday, to meet him, and he sang her happy birthday. It's a long story that's like insane, but, you know, she tells people this story, and like teachers or whatever, and they didn't believe her. You know, it's like they thought she was this young kid was making it up. So these weren't like lengthy interactions. They were brief and cordial and, you know, rushed, to say the least, because he's Ringo Starr. He's always being pulled in many directions. But I had at least the benefit of having been in a room with him and watching how he reacts to people and how people react to him. So the first time I interviewed him was over the phone, and it was really brief, and it was for Esquire, and you know, it just kind of came and went. It was very focused on a book he'd done of photographs called Photograph for Genesis Publications. And he just gave me like little quick stories about 5 or 10 photos. And it didn't last, as most of his interviews do, more than 10 minutes. You know, it was just sort of really quick. It was close to Christmas time, you know, really, you know, nothing monumental. But then a few months later, I don't remember the occasion, but I was working on a piece for Esquire about Hard Day's, the 1964 tour, and how they invented the stadium tour, and Hard Day's Night was coming out in a re-release. And, you know, he had an art exhibition here in New York City, and so they set aside a room for him to do some TV press, but also to do some one-on-ones. And I think I was the only print journalist there. And so they said, you know, come early so you can kind of get the lay of the land and see what things are like and whatever. And he did recognize me, which helps, you know, I mean, and I could tell right away, they tell you don't ask about the Beatles. They don't do that, I don't think, anymore, but they don't tell me, but because I sort of know the drill, but they tell you not to ask about the Beatles. And, you know, I saw him being interviewed for, I think, Canadian television, and then another interview for Entertainment Tonight, which is a program here in America, sort of tabloidy program. And he got really irritated when they were fixated on the Beatles. He'd allow the sort of odd question, but when they would, you know, drill down on whatever it was they wanted to get, then they just needed, like, it's TV. They just need, like, that 5-10 second clip. You could see there was a sort of uncomfortable thing to it. I think he's more at peace with his legacy now, but this was 15 years ago, and you know, we're all much older, and the Beatles have become even bigger than they were then, believe it or not. So then I get in this room with him, and, you know, he recognized me, and we were chatting, and there's some great pictures of it, and you can tell that we were both sort of loose, but the preparation was, you know, this is Ringo. You don't really need to prepare to interview Ringo. And I don't ever, almost, unless there's very specific things I need to get, I don't prepare questions. I want it to be, I come from the sort of Dick Cavett school, if your listeners know who he is, who I interviewed once and said, did you used to watch me when you were a kid? Because, you know, I think it's, you get them, find the common ground, and then, you know, the subject will sort of, the best subject will rise to the top. And so as we sat down, I reminded him who I was and mentioned a couple of our mutual friends. And he was like, oh, we don't have mutual friends. So I mentioned, you know, and he's joking, but he didn't believe it. So I mentioned 2 or 3. And at first he was a little suspicious. And then he was like, oh, we do have mutual friends. And so we started talking about this friend of ours who's making a record and, you know, just normal stuff. And so then we started talking about his art and the All-Star Band, who I think were either on tour or about to do a tour. And we were I sort of cleverly slipped in because I wanted to get this for the piece about, you know, playing stadiums in 1965. I said, oh, well, you know, how is it different with the all-star bands than, you know, when you were in your other band or, you know, in the past, I said, in the past. And he said, well, we didn't have monitors in the Beatles, you know. And there it was. It was like he had mentioned the Beatles. And then he started talking about, you know, watching John's ass and, you know, trying to hang on to the movement of the guitars or, you know, because he couldn't hear in the back. You know, he was just kind of like their motions were driving him and he was driving them. And it was this sort of weird situation. So, and then we were, you know, all of a sudden we were talking about the Beatles and he'd brought it up and it was natural as can be. So I that's always been my advice to people who interview, you know, people like that is, you know, if you can, if you have any common ground at all, that's a good start, but sometimes you just don't. And, but you can find it, you know, it's like Jimmy Page is a bootleg fan, you know, so you can talk about bootleg. I'm not a huge Zeppelin fan, but I love bootlegs. And so we got into that, you know, it's that. And then if they bring up the topic that, you know, not the topic that they, that they're there to talk about, but the topic that they want to talk about, then that was, I felt the trick. And I, you know, that has worked many times with Ringo. You know, if you just sort of bring up George, who, you know, when I was interviewing him, had only been gone, you know, 8 or 10, 12 years at that point, he would bring him up very wistfully and he would want to talk about George Harrison or Billy Preston or any of these people. You know, this time was a little more nuts and bolts. What did you think of Get Back? And this is what he thought of Get Back. And that was kind of, you know, again, like the first interview.
Mm. What one person growing up shaped you more than any other?
John Lennon.
Who you are now, who shaped you?
Yeah, yes, absolutely John Lennon. You know, there were certainly historical figures that as a very young kid fascinated me. But, you know, when I started to become aware of the world around me and I saw the Beatles on Saturday afternoon TV and I pulled out my the records that my brother and sister had left behind when they went to college and these things, I just, you know, he was the one I couldn't take my eyes off of. You know, he was just sort of just different. And the weird thing was my brother-in-law and my sister lived here in New York City and he was around, you know, I mean, I remember my brother telling me this story about, you know, standing on a street corner and seeing him walking toward him. You know, I mean, he was just a guy on the Upper West Side and the Beatles weren't, you know, sort of the Beatles in all capital letters the way they are now. They were, but there was a dip in the mid to late 70s where they were a little bit old music, you know. My friends were listening to Kiss, and I just thought that was garbage. I just didn't get it at all. And the Beatles were this sort of endless well of, you know, you could go at, you know, by the time I got to them in the 70s, you could go from Strawberry Fields Forever to She Loves You with the flip of a record. And how did those four guys do those two things only a couple of years apart? That just, like, you know, even at a young age when I was just starting to try to play the guitar or try to play the piano, it was, you know, like the level of creativity I could tell was sort of otherworldly. But he was the one who was, you know, he was the loudmouth too. When you're a kid, the funny loudmouth is always the one you're going to focus on. You're not, as a young boy, you're not going to focus on the cute one or the sort of, you know, spiritual one or the guy in the back who seems like a lot of fun, but he's playing the drums. You're going to focus on the guy with all the charisma and who's the loudmouth and tells the jokes. So that was part of it as well. But look, there was a point in my life where I used to say to anybody who would listen that John Lennon was more significant in my life to my own father. Because, you know, we were so far apart generationally, my dad and I wasn't listening to what he was saying. I was listening to what John Lennon was saying. If he was interviewed, you know, in Rolling Stone or, you know, when he came back and was making Double Fantasy, there were all the news reports. I visited New York and I was looking for him, you know, he'd be walking around the Upper West Side looking for him. So it was, you know, it was just sort of all consuming. It wasn't fanaticism, but it was, he was just so inspirational in the way everything I learned about him was like, you know, even the bed-in to me at 12 or 13 years old seemed like a great idea. It's just like, it's such a fuck you. And I, you know, with punk happening, he was such a punk before that term even existed. So I think that was the guy.
If you could relive a six-month period of your life between the ages of 0 and 20, what 6 months would it be and why?
I was in a band in 1985, 84, 85, 86, called the Mindless Thinkers, who we got our name from Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. We had a drunken gig. And it was my first professional band. I'd had some bands that played, like, you know, school dances and things like that. But this was a band that played clubs and opened for national touring acts and that kind of thing. And we were only 17 or 18 years old. And in the course of maybe 18 months or so, we, you know, did incredibly well. We made a single, we made an album, we were on a compilation record that was, you know, we got offered a tour in Japan. And, you know, it's just crazy. We played all over the East Coast here in the United States. And it was colleges who were, you know, in 1985, very appreciative of that kind of punky, poppy. We were sort of part Clash, part Jam, part Kinks and Who, Small Faces. You know, it's that weird amalgam of these very old styles in some respects. But, and it blew up, as things do when you're 18 or 19 years old. And I just thought, oh, well, I'll just go to New York and start another band. And what I didn't realize was it's really hard to recreate not just the magic of your first band, but the magic of a group of guys who can get together in a room and make something better than what you intended when you wrote the song, or when you know, or create their own arrangement of a classic song, or, you know, whatever it was that not every group of three or four or five guys can do that. So that was a pretty magical time. And I would never want to go back to it. We reunited once when Joe Strummer died. We got asked to do a show at CBGB's here right before it closed in a tribute to him the night the Clash were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, you know, I've had this conversation with Paul Weller many times that he just finds it really hard to play those songs from when he was young because he doesn't relate to the guy who wrote those songs. And I was playing these songs that were, you know, already 20 years old or however long it was. And I just, you know, the things you have to say when you're 18 years old are not the things you want to say when you're 30, whatever. So it was pretty hard to do. And there was a lot of interest in us continuing. And I, you know, the bass player's the guy, he's the Paul Simonon. He's the guy who will never do it. But, you know, I was like, oh, well, it's cool. It's always cool when people want to see you play that badly. But I just, it's hard to go back to that.
So I'm going to ask the same question, but from 20 onwards. So if there was a 6 month period from your professional career that you'd like to relive because it was a particular roller coaster or a particular ride that was so enjoyable or emotional, whatever it might be, what would it be? What would that 6 month period be and why?
I think, wow, it's really hard because, you know, your immediate thought is sort of, you know, when both of my kids were born, I took some time off and was around, did the house husband thing. So that's pretty memorable. But in my mid-20s, I connected with Pete Townsend. We became friends. And I ended up going out on the road with him for a while. And then he paid for and was sort of executive producer on these demos I did. And we then, you know, shopped it to record companies and, you know, whatever. And there was a sort of a 2 year period or so there where we were in each other's pockets just constantly. And look, it's pretty well known the shape he was in the early 90s and I wasn't much better. And we probably both of us almost died on several occasions from one sort of drug or drink or another. So it was more, like you said, it was more emotional and memorable and it was good. But it was good in many respects because I became, you know, a true friend with this guy that I had to disassociate from the guy that I remembered seeing on my TV playing at Monterey Pop or whatever. You know, it's like, this isn't the same guy. This guy that's sitting, I'm sitting at dinner with is, you know, flesh and blood human being who, you know, we're just talking about, you know, the first probably 3, 4, maybe 6 months that I knew him, we didn't even talk about music. And purposely on my part, and I think he just has other interests, you know, a lot of other interests. And so our friendship was built on, you know, sort of the books we were reading and the things we were interested in, the culture or politics. But I got to play with him a bunch of times, and I got to like sing Won't Get Fooled Again with him on guitar. And we played a loft party here that a drummer friend of mine, a photographer friend of mine threw. And it was just a pickup band of, you know, the guys. There was a, you know, I remember walking in with him, and there was in one room a full stage setup. And he kind of was like, oh shit, they're going to want to, you know, they're going to want me to play. And he went off and did his thing. And at some point later in the evening, I found myself on the stage with one of the guys from the Tommy Play and a few other musicians. And we were playing Sympathy for the Devil. And, you know, like, as everybody knows, at a certain point in the song, everything sort of kicks in. And when everything kicked in, there was this gring sound to my left. And I looked over, and there he was playing the guitar. So I'm playing Sympathy for the Devil with Pete Townsend. And that's, I got to tell you, better than playing Won't Get Fooled Again. Although, you know, I pulled out my best scream when we did that. But, you know, when you're playing something that's not his, so you're just musicians, there's a different connection, because you're not trying to impress him. You are, of course. Let me correct myself. But you're just guys playing a Stone.
What did you absorb from him, perhaps in his process or his practice, that now has kind of osmosed into your way of working through that time of?
You know, I think I was incredibly lazy in critiquing my own stuff, in editing my own stuff, in continuing the writing process, even when I maybe thought it was done. You know, I would typically, back before I met him, I would write a song, and that would be it. That would be the song. You know, I'd sit down, I'd have an idea. I have the time and energy to sort of complete it in one go anyway. But then that would be it. And I would be very precious about editing or changing it. And the one thing I learned was, if someone has an idea that makes it better, or if you have an idea that makes it better subsequent to that, by all means, make it better. And never stop working. Never stop playing. Never stop working. Always have a guitar around. Always be open. Because a lot of times you're just this conduit to that inspiration that, you know, we don't know where that inspiration comes from. And so if you're walking down the street, now we all have iPhones and we can hum it into our iPhones. But, you know, back then you had to stop. Stop what you were doing, and even if that created tension in a relationship or a social situation or whatever, if you had to leave, excuse yourself, because you had an idea that you couldn't stop thinking about, by all means, go engage yourself in the creative process rather than do it. So if you're, you know, sometimes people, oh, he was distant, or he was this, or he was that. His mind was probably on something else. He never stops creating, and I think that was probably the most important lesson.
You've worked with some of the most powerful people in the music industry, both collaborating, as you just described there, or interviewing them and being around them and supporting maybe releases of their books, et cetera, et cetera. So you've worked with some of the most powerful personalities in the music industry. What would you say would be their collective biggest weakness?
Well, not all of them, you know, because of that creative muse being indulged for a long period of time in their lives over, you know, connecting with people often, they can be incredibly selfish in putting that ahead of, and look, I'm guilty of it too. Most musicians are, but this is at a different level. If you've had that kind of success, I think they're willing to put their creativity ahead of all else and try to surround themselves, not always with the best people, but the people who will indulge that.
Yes, men. It's kind of yes,
not,
people.
Not, what, not just yes. Yeah, absolutely. We all like yes, men. I mean, you know, we can't chastise rock and roll stars for wanting yes. You know, we all have the friend that tells us we're great, and that's okay. We do it for them too. But, you know, in relationships as well, we will often choose people, friends or lovers, who are maybe better for us as a creative person. They will tolerate certain things, or they will encourage certain things, than maybe the person who would challenge. And I think that was also something I learned from Pete as well, that, you know, the people who challenge you. Look, he's a guy who has been in the stardom bubble since he was, I think, 19 years old. He doesn't really know in any meaningful way the life that you and I live. And look, there are people who, you know, I live in New York City and I write about music and I play rock and roll for a living. And I know my kids' friends think that, you know, I have this life that's completely different than their parents. And I do in many respects. But, you know, this is exponential. And I don't mean to pick on Pete. It's just, you know, we were just talking about him. But it's true of many of the famous or well-known or high-level musicians that I've worked with, that they are, you know, they put that creativity ahead of all else, and that does create holes in their lives. So I guess that would be, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think so.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
About kind of your children's friends and maybe their parents. When you speak to someone like that who's really outside the music industry, what's one thing you'd want them to know about the industry that's a reality that might be a blind spot?
I will bring this back to a great anecdote about Pete. When my son was about 4 or 5 years old, I took him to a Who show. We were backstage at Madison Square Garden, and because my son wanted to be Liam Gallagher, he had seen Oasis on, you know, TV. And I don't remember if I'd taken him to see Oasis, but he was fixated on Liam. He thought that's the job I want. He was only 4 or 5 years old, but he would stand, you know, around singing with his hands behind his back. I mean, he was like, you know, as 4 year olds do. And Pete, we had a conversation about this, and, you know, Pete's thing was like, he really needs to understand, you know, because Pete's parents were in the music business at a relatively low level, but they were working musicians. He needs to understand what goes into this. And so backstage at this concert, he walked him around to all the trucks and the crew guys and the rigging and the, you know, whatever that it's not. And the you know, the dressing room was, you know, it wasn't nice. I mean, they make it nice for a band like The Who, but it wasn't anything fancy. The old fruit plate. And, you know, it's, you know how this is. And I think it was, I mean, he also did let him stand on the stage when the lights went up and they played Can't Explain. So that kind of undercut everything he was trying to do. However, I think my kids have been at my gigs that for me were monumental gigs. And my partner has taken pictures of them in the back of the venue. You know, like I can be on stage with Earl Slick, the Bowie band, you know, whatever it was. And my kids are there and it's late and they're asleep. So, you know, I think it's important for them to understand that people to understand that it's a job and that it's really, really, really hard work. We don't get I always say this. I think it was Duke Ellington who said this, but we don't get paid for the hour and a half we're on stage. We get paid for the other 22 and a half hours that we're humping the gear and dealing with sound check and dealing with the business people and trying to get paid, and is the merch right? You know, all these things that we have to do on a day-to-day basis, that's the stuff we get paid for. The part, the 90 minutes on stage that everybody gets to see and thinks that's the easiest job in the world, which, by the way, it isn't. You know, that's really what we get paid for. That's the other part. Show me the way.
touched upon Earl there. Obviously, such character and obviously such a legend, Bowie, a guitarist. What's something that someone would learn from working with Earl they wouldn't learn from anyone?
There's no bad ideas. We've been in the studio now many, many times. We just finished making a new record of mine. You know, as a producer, songwriter, you always have an idea of what you want. And, or, you know, most of the time. And you might have an idea for a riff. You might have an idea for a hook. You might, you know, whatever it is. And the best thing to do when you have somebody like that playing for you is to let them do what they do. You know, Bowie is well known as being this sort of casting director. He'd find the right person for the role, and then he would let them play that role. And he would offer them maybe a critique here or there, a little direction, quote unquote, but he would, you know, let, if you've got Earl Slick standing next to you, let him come up with the monster riff. I mean, and it might not happen the first time he hears it, or as fast as you want it to. He might fumble a little bit as he's trying to find, it's always going to sound great because it's him and his fingers are amazing, but you know, it might take a couple of passes to get to that magic. And all of a sudden when it comes, it's way beyond what anything that you had imagined and anything he had imagined, because it just happens. So I think that's the thing. Always be open to that.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I know you've worked with like Duff McKagan as well. And you know, you've obviously got a huge status yourself, but obviously there are times where you're working with people with a, you know, very kind of significant status in the industry. And it reminds me of, you know, I'd just like to ask you about this whole area about almost giving direction to people. If, you know, if you've got any young musicians listening to this, which there will be musicians who are listening to this. If you're giving direction to someone of status, like how comfortable you feel in those shoes. So it reminds me of the analogy that, so when Ricky Gervais was directing Robert De Niro, and Robert De Niro was doing a scene with Steve Merchant and another member of his show, extras. And in between each take, Gervais would go up to Steve Merchant, the other member, and just say, okay, do a bit more of this, a bit less of this, and then walk back. And after the third or fourth take, De Niro said, what about me? Do I need to be doing anything else? And Gervais was like, oh, I didn't think I need to direct you. Like, you guys, you know what you're doing. So I wonder if there's ever been that kind of like dynamic where you felt a bit unsure whether to say, can you do more of something, less of something, because of that status and how you navigated those waters.
When I was younger, we all have those moments where we feel like pretenders. There's always, you know, it doesn't have to be Earl Slick or Duff McKagan. You can be in the studio with your buddy that you grew up with, who's just a better guitar player than you. And you feel a little intimidated telling this guy, well, I have this idea that I think is better, right? We all have egos. We all, you know, have that pretender syndrome. I think, you know, if you don't get over that at a certain point in your career, if you don't feel confident in your own creativity, your own ideas. You don't want to be an asshole about it, but I think it is important to be able to, you know, direct people in a professional manner. If you can't do that, then you're in the wrong business, you know? I mean, I think there was a point, I don't really know when it happened, but there was a point in my career where I felt, well, I've done this a really long time and people who I respect are playing with me. They must think there's something there. I'm just going to be me and say, no, that's not what I want, or more of that, or whatever. Because, you know, the other thing I found is, as a songwriter, musicians who are players first, I'm a songwriter first and a player second, but musicians who are players first and maybe songwriters not at all, or certainly second, they're looking to the songwriter to tell them what they want and what to do. They want that direction. They come to you because you've got the songs. They don't write songs. So, wow, this guy has this cool song. And I think that also gives you some confidence when you've got, you know, I've worked with people who've played with some very big names, and they'll say, wow, I really like this song, or this is a great song. And they're not, you know, they're just saying it. You didn't ask them for that. They're not doing it to prop up your ego in any meaningful way. And so I think when that starts to happen, it feels pretty good and gives you, you know, that sort of boost of adrenaline and confidence to be a little more forthright. Not, again, you know, there's a fine line between forthright and being an asshole. So I think if you can be kind of, you know, really honest about your opinion and what what you think of what they're adding to whatever you're doing. I find people...
It's a great answer. From your perspective, both as a performer and having kind of, as I say, engaged and interviewed a lot of incredible musicians, what underrated skill do you think every musician should have?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think people know this now, especially with like YouTube and, you know, all these tutorials that we see, but in all things in life, listening more, you know, I think especially, you know, for a guy like me who I never wanted to be a front man. I always wanted to be in a gang. You know, I liked the Beatles or the Small Faces or, you know, I liked that gang mentality. But at a certain point, it became obvious that, you know, after the Mindless Thinkers broke up, that it's really hard to find people to truly collaborate with. That, you know, if you're a songwriter and a singer, people are looking to you for most of the ideas. And it's very easy to get off on the power trip of being like, well, my name is on the marquee, so it doesn't mean shit. You know, yes, but no, because the reason people are there are because of the sound you create, which is not necessarily, oftentimes, not just you. In fact, it's almost never just you. So, you know, I think in all things in life, whether it's, you know, how do I get the interviews I do? I listen really intently. How do I, you know, I come prepared, obviously. I made light of it earlier, but I obviously know an awful lot about my subject matter already. I didn't need to research Ringo because he's fucking Ringo. But, you know, there are times when you need to kind of check your facts. But but just in life, in the studio, on stage, in any creative situation, but in any life situation, the more you listen, the more you're going to get out of any circumstance, I think.
Imagine you're in a boxing match and you've been knocked down. You've been on the ropes. You're flat out. The referee's counting. 6, 7, 8. What song could come on your headphones right then that's going to reinvigorate you to get back up again?
Jesus. It's like the Rorschach test of podcasts. Let's see. I mean, the first thing that comes into my mind is Fucking in the Bushes by Oasis. The sort of walk-on music, right?
So that's exactly what happens in Snatch. You know the film Snatch?
Yeah,
that's
Yeah.
It's exactly.
Now that I say it, I realize that. But yeah, I mean, it's funny. There's such a sort of cocaine rush to that sound. There's plenty of them, certainly from the 90s when we were all much, you know, much worse at living life the way we do now. But the bad old 90s, as they call them, I'll stick with that.
It's a good answer. It's a good answer. Alternatively, what song makes you choke up no matter how many times you hear it?
Wow. These are good. It changes, but I'll say Northern Sky by Nick Drake.
Why?
You know, part of it is Nick Drake. You know, it's just such a sad story. But that song, there's something about that song that, I mean, first of all, it's not a song I've heard a million times. You know, there's a lot of songs that probably at one time in my life did it, but maybe have lost that polish, that sheen, because, you know, how many times in your life can you hear The Long and Winding Road or whatever it is? Which I thought was interesting to see that the other guys didn't really like that song very much.
Yeah, right? It's completely indifferent.
Yeah.
Even I sense Paul at some point. He's like, okay, yeah,
it was just another song. Yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something in his delivery. You know, he uses these strange tunings, his voice, the way it's recorded. It's so open and endearing and mournful. You know, it's like we put the tragedy that was Nick Drake on his music. So there's that part too. But I think just as a song, if you didn't know who he was, it's hard to imagine that. But there's something that the reason I said it was because whenever I hear that song, I tend to stop what I'm doing. So I don't think I get wistful or weepy, but it does make me reflective in a way that a lot of music is just, it's in the background.
If you were to find out tomorrow that the world was going to end, what would be your biggest regret musically? What would be the thing you think, fuck, I never had time to get around to doing that. I wish I'd found time to do that. Music.
Well, you know, can they be dead? Yeah. Well, I never got to sit around and play guitars and talk with George Harrison. I mean, I think there are so many people in the business who are interesting or great players or have led really full lives, but it's very rare that they've done all three, you know? And he ticks so many boxes for me. Such a fascinating character. Yeah, it would be George.
Other than when Ringo recognized you and said hello, what would you say is the most surreal experience you've ever had in the music industry, which was just like, imagine telling my younger self this is happening. What would you say the most surreal experience is that you've had?
Well, that I talked about it earlier, that night that we played at that loft party and, you know, we were playing Sympathy for the Devil and Pete started strumming the guitar and I looked and he was in that kind of, I will say this and people will know it immediately. No, it wasn't that. It wasn't. He's swinging his arm. It was that sort of, you know, like military stance, you know, that where he's holding the guitar like a gun and, you know, he's just sort of pounding it, you know, strumming it really hard and pounding. And I actually got home at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning after that and called my two best friends from childhood and said, you are not going to fucking believe what just happened to me. And it was, you know, there were other times, I've had many times on stage where it's like you're playing with somebody whose records you grew up with, or, you know, I came on after Donovan at a festival once, and he came down the stairs and I was going up the stairs and he said, beat that kid. I was like, you know, because we'd been backstage all afternoon. I just thought that was really clever and funny and also kind of put me on. We talked about it afterward. It kind of put me on edge in a good way. It was like, oh, fuck you, Donovan. You know, I'm going to with your acoustic guitar. So I've had plenty of those moments, but that would be the one, because it was just, it was the first time something like that had happened. That was not like, you know, a college radio guy that we were opening for, but this was like a monumental legend in rock and roll history. And he was just a guy playing the guitar at this party. And yet, you know, it was, I can picture it, like everything about it in my mind right now. And it was, you know, 30 years ago.
Nice. So I'm going to preempt this next question by actually telling you my answer to this, which I wouldn't normally do, but I'm only going to do it because I think you'd be interested. But the question is what's the most important piece of music memorabilia you have? And I'm going to tell you mine is what's behind me at the moment, because that's a gold disc of Imagine. But just underneath is a strip of wood of John Lennon's front door of his house in Tittenhurst. And that's the kind of thing I would save if the house was burning down, kind of thing, and the family was safe. Is anything that's particularly important to you? You know, is it like a pass that you have, or, you know, something's been given to you that's particularly important to you as a piece of memorabilia that you would grab if you had to?
You know, over the years, I've collected a lot of stuff. I'm looking around and I have right over there, and this isn't even that important to me. It's just there on the shelf, a picture of George Harrison signed by Noel Gallagher. It's just weird and funny, you know? It's like there's so many. It would be really hard. I think I'd probably grab one of my guitars, which isn't technically memorabilia, but it fits because I have a guitar that's just a few serial numbers off from George Harrison's guitar. The Beatles all had Epiphone casinos, and I once took this Epiphone casino that I owned to a private party at the Gibson showroom here, and the tech who was there to help us out like flipped out over this guitar, and he said, can I take a look at that, and put it up on the bench, check the serial number, and he said, I think this was made on the same day as George's. And I'm like, and it's identical. If you see pictures of his and mine, they're virtually identical. It's got a stock Bigsby, which is very unusual, and it's got the same headstock, which was a transition headstock at the time. It's just really strange. And so, you know, if this were 10 years ago and there were Japanese collectors snapping up all that Beatles memorabilia, somebody would pay a lot of money for it. Now everybody's on a fixed income who's a, you know, rich Beatle fan. But, you know, there was something about, I wanted one of those guitars as a kid so badly. They were really, really, really hard to find. I was on tour once in Buffalo or somewhere outside Buffalo, and I walked into a guitar store and it was way up near the ceiling on the wall. And I walked in and I said, oh, I'll take that. And they were like, you want to play it? And I said, I'll take it. I do want to play it, but I'll just take it. Because they were so hard to find at that time. This is before they were reissued and everything. And, you know, so there's like, I've played it, I've taken it around the world. I've, you know, before I knew that I should leave it in the closet, it used to go everywhere with me. So there's a story to it. And that it has sort of this maybe weird pedigree makes it, you know, just a little more special and makes it a little bit memorabilia, I guess. I do have, by the way, though, second place is, I do have a box set of More Blood, More Tracks, the box set that I did for you know, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks a couple years ago, signed to me by Bob. So,
wow.
Yeah, there's that. And a Mono Blonde on Blonde that he signed for me. So those are pretty prized possessions, but they have less meaning because they, you know, I wasn't there when he did it. And it was, you know, it's like a lot of these things are just, you know, autographs are just autographs. They're not, you know, it's more representative of a moment in time than it is the actual signature, as far as I'm concerned.
We're going to begin to wrap up. There's a couple of questions here that I really want to ask, and I think I'll save it till now. So who provided the biggest challenge when interviewing them? So who was the person, who's the biggest kind of asshole, or just kind of the person who was most challenging to interview that made it awkward, uncomfortable, if that ever happened?
Yeah, I've been very lucky, but I would say Bill Kreutzmann from The Grateful Dead. It's the drummer from The Grateful Dead. It was very important to him that I was aware of who he was on numerous occasions during our interview. And, you know, obviously I was interviewing because I knew who he was. He just was ornery in the worst possible way. And I rarely come out of an interview feeling it. Not only was it terrible, but it just, the person was awful. You know, there are people you don't like, or you wouldn't want to spend time with, or you know, it's part of the job. But I have a tendency, I'm very fortunate. I don't work for one publication. I generally only do interviews with people that I want to interview. I'm there because I know who they are and I'm interested in learning more about it. That was an assignment. I'm not a Grateful Dead fan by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I did see them back in the day, but I certainly knew who he was and knew the significance and had read the book. And it wasn't that. It was that he was, there was that. The other one, which I'd forgotten because Bill always stands out, was Graham Nash, who I had a long lunch with once and found him to be incredibly egotistical and just really difficult to be around. And, you know, constantly reminding everybody at the table who he was and what he had done. And it was strange because I had just come from a week or so before interviewing David Crosby, and our 20 minutes turned into 3.5 hours. And we talked about every aspect of his career. We went through like every Birds album. I'm not a CSNY fan, but so maybe there's a theme here. But, and I told him that, and he laughed. He thought it was hilarious. Like, he didn't care. That didn't matter to him. I came, I was prepared, I knew the subject matter. We had a great time. We're still friends to this day, and it's been 10 years. But Graham, it was, oh my God, it was the longest lunch of my life. And I know people like him because he's very polished and charming. He can be very charming, but I just found him to be an asshole. So there it is for podcast land.
No, there's a piece around recognition here, isn't it? You know, in both of those cases, there's someone who either feels like they should be recognized more, or, you know, there's a thing around recognition.
There was an ego thing going on that, you know, I'm there because you are who you are. You don't need to impress me with who you are or remind me who you are. We're here because you're Graham Nash. But look, you know, that's not to say he doesn't have redeeming qualities. It was just a really awkward and painful experience from my point of view.
So you mentioned you got a new record, I think, that you are going to be, it's been recorded, or is it in the process still? And I mean, that leads me on to, you know, looking a year from now, so we're just approaching the end of 2021. What do you want to look back on 2002 having achieved?
Yeah, well, we, during lockdown, we recorded a new record, mostly remotely. When things eased up in the spring, we were able to go into the studio and record, you know, in person. Slick and I spent about a week with the producer up in Connecticut at his studio. The cool thing about lockdown was everybody I'd ever wanted to get to be on it was free. So, as you mentioned, Duff is on it, Slick is on it, Jeremy Stacey from Noel's band, and Jess Greenfield.
He's a wicked drummer. And he's such a good drummer.
Best drummer in the world. I mean, just so great. YC, Jess Greenfield, as I said. Bunch of the guys from Weller's band, Steve Craddock, Ben McTalbot from the Style Council. Hopefully, after not long after this gets recorded, Paul Weller's going to add some things to the record as well. You know, just pretty much everybody and anybody that I'm friends with in the music business who, and Gene Parsons from the Byrds. I mean, I just asked everybody who's sort of around doing things or not doing anything, you know, hey, if I send you this track, could you add something? And this was a case where people would often not ask me for ideas. They just sort of throw a bunch of ideas down and I'd get to choose. And that was a really fun process to kind of sculpt and paint the picture that I wanted from the elements that I was provided. And so that should come out next year. You know, it's the supply chain is difficult and the vinyl issue is difficult. So it may not be toward the till the end of the year. And then are you saying you want me to look back on 2021 or 2022?
Well, in a year from now, what do you want to have achieved? But is there anything else you want to kind of talk about you've been doing recently of note?
Yes. I keep lobbying Weller to let me and Slick. He's offered us Black Barn when we're in the UK, and I'm going to take him up on that. But I keep lobbying him, and he's a little dodgy about us joining him on stage when they play New York. I just want 5 minutes on stage with Weller. I'm not asking for much. Like every fanboy, you know, I've been elevated to friend in some regard. So I'm like, every time I talk to him, I push the envelope and I'm like, and he, you know, it's funny because I talked to him back in the spring and we were talking about the record and he knew that Steve and Ben had played on it. And he said, oh, you should send me a couple of tracks. I'll put some vocals and guitar on it. And I was like, I got off the phone and I was like, did that just fucking happen? But I said, I listened back to the recording when I was when the interview got transcribed and I was like, holy shit. My response was, yeah. And when you come to the States, you got to let me and Slick play with you guys. It's like, I never miss an opportunity to lobby for this. So that would be my wish on my wish list for 2022. Everything else is gravy. I mean, if things ease up in the next couple of months and we get to play live gigs with regularity again, things are now being canceled again here. Get to get out on the road. I'm supposed to come to the UK and Europe with Slick, do some shows to support the record and get around the States some, you know, just to get back to some semblance of normalcy would be just a relief and see people. I mean, there's people in the UK I just haven't seen in a very long time. People in the States, people in New York City that I haven't seen in a very long time. I think that would be my biggest wish. And not just for myself, obviously, for everybody. We all need.
Well, listen, good luck with all of that. I mean, there's so much you've got exciting that's taking place. I mean, we just hope that a spread of Omicron, as we record this, isn't going to derail too much on both sides of the pond. Thank you for your wisdom, your insight, kind of your experiences, you know, passing that wonderful knowledge on. And good luck with everything that's coming your way in the next year. And thanks for being such a great guest on the stage.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So that was Jeff Slate. And isn't it interesting to, you know, get a music journalist on here? It's the first time we've done that. Maybe it's something we should do again. Coming up soon, we're going to have Paul Gallagher, DJ Paul Gallagher, who's going to be returning to the Stage Left podcast. So that's Liam and Noel's brother. He reached out and he's going to come down to see us in Brighton and visit us when we can. And that should be quite an interesting one. We've got Rob Coombs from Supergrass as well. He's going to be coming on the podcast soon, as well as Jules Holland's brother, Christopher Holland, who some of you will know is a legendary organ player in his own right, part of Jules's Rhythm and Blues Orchestra, and has also worked with the likes of Paul Weller too. So some exciting episodes coming up. We'll see you next time.
This episode was scored, mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job. Follow us on Instagram at the Stage Left Podcast, where you'll see behind-the-scenes photos from our interviews with members of Oasis, Queen, and Madness.